You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at 1 Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Emma-Louise Fenelon.
Today's offering on the podcast is a particularly special one. Not only is it our 100th episode and our first episode since we reached a quarter of a million listens, but it is the first time we welcome Neil Sheldon QC of 1 Crown Office Row to the podcast. Neil, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much.
Today we will be discussing expert evidence, a topic close to the heart of all those practicing in clinical negligence. The recent trend in judicial criticism of expert witnesses in clinical negligence claims reached its pinnacle in the judgment of Mr. Justice Garnham in ZZZ and Yeovil District Hospital NHS Foundation Trust, a High Court decision from this year. That judgment, along with a number of others, have contained trenchant criticism to similar effect. Neil is here to provide some helpful guidance as to how to avoid the more egregious type of error to which even experienced experts can often be prone. Neil, after reading through the various judgments we're going to talk about today, it occurred to me that giving evidence is not for the faint-hearted. How then can a barrister help his or her expert avoid humiliation in court?
Well, Emma, I think the first lesson that an expert needs to learn before they go anywhere near a witness box is to have clear and succinctly in their minds the Bolan-Bolitho tests that they are going to need to apply anytime they're asked a question about negligence. That is, as we know, the only test that the court may apply and the only question that the expert should answer. But there can be a tendency, I think, on the part of some experts to regard the straightforward question of whether they consider the care provided to be negligent as being rather indelicate or distasteful. You frequently encounter euphemisms, particularly if the defendant doctor happens to be in the room. Reports, and more often perhaps joint statements, often contain language such as inadvisable or not ideal, or it would have been better if. And that is not good enough. The expert needs to understand the nature of the question asked and has to give a clear opinion on it, which will be sustained at trial. And he or she needs to state that clearly in the report, the joint statement, and in any advice given at conference. A real concern, I think, is the possibility that a lack of enthusiasm for dealing head-on with the Bolan test in the preparation for a case may disguise an inability to articulate it when the critical moment arrives. And we have an example from the case of ZZZ that we've both read.
We do. I'll read out this particularly painful passage for a Mr. Jamil, and here it is. More fundamental, it was apparent in the course of the evidence that Mr. Jamil did not know what the test for breach of duty is in a professional negligence case. He only succeeded in articulating something approaching the correct test after it had been explained to him by his barrister. That piece of incompetence was underlined by the fact that in a county court in March of this year, Mr. Jamil had again been unable to articulate the test he was applying when advising that another doctor was negligent. His explanation to me for his inability to describe the Bolan test on the previous occasion was that he had had a mental block whilst giving evidence. That was palpable nonsense, since he had made the same mistake in the course of contributing to a joint report in that earlier case. I also note with some concern that Mr. Jamil appeared quite unable to appreciate, or at least to acknowledge, how serious these inadequacies were in an expert giving evidence to the court in a case relating to clinical negligence allegations. I regard Mr. Jamil as a wholly unreliable witness.
Now, it might be tempting to write that off as an isolated, if unhappy, episode, exposing the lack of understanding of a single inadequate expert, or perhaps an example of a judge being in a particularly bad mood. But I think that would be unwise, because it seems from the judgments as though this is a deficiency from which even the most experienced experts can suffer. Take this similar example from the case of Harrison Johnson a couple of years ago. Another unsatisfactory feature of Mr. Kirkpatrick's approach was that he appeared to equate professional negligence with the degree of competence that had to be demonstrated to pass a surgical examination. Thus, when he was asked in cross-examination whether, at the time he wrote his report, he considered the CT scans to be indicative of negligence, he replied, "It was substandard, in that the pathology had not been addressed." When counsel asked whether by substandard he meant negligent, his answer was, "I think that the operation was not carried out to a standard expected of, for example, an exiting exam individual." This led me to question in my own mind whether Mr. Kirkpatrick had ever addressed his mind properly to the principles set out in Bolam.
So the bottom line is, the first time an expert is asked the direct, straightforward question of whether or not he or she considers the treatment in question to have been negligent should not be in the witness box.
Absolutely. Nor, I think, should the witness box be the place for them to try out their understanding of the standard to be applied for the first time. Experts simply cannot be permitted to fudge their way through this issue with creative or ambiguous language. Before they give evidence, I think, you need to be sure that they know what the test is and they've rigorously applied it in formulating their opinion. As those cases show, experience is clearly no guarantee.
So first lesson, understand Bolam and Bolitho. Second lesson, resist the temptation to widen the brief.
Yes, there is a common fault, I think, that emerges regularly in clinical negligence reports and which has been exposed in a couple of the recent cases. And that is experts who are instructed to deal with causation, expressing a view on breach of duty. Now, these experts are usually eminent, and the opinions they express are cogent. When that happens, there is an inevitable temptation to leave the opinion in the report on the basis that, well, it can't do any harm, and there's always a chance that the judge may attach some weight to it. But in reality, I think, the risk almost always outweighs the benefits, particularly by the time the case gets to trial. Asking an expert why he included an opinion on breach of duty in a causation report, or how he or she felt able to opine on the actions of, for example, a GP, given that they inhabit a completely different specialism, is such an easy cross-examination win for the opposing advocate. There's simply no good answer to the question. Either the expert says he or she was asked to include the opinion, which looks bad, or that it was included on his or her initiative, which frankly looks even worse.
And again, ZZZ provides an unfortunate example for Mr. Jamil, in which Mr. Justice Garnham said, "In the course of reports apparently directed towards causation, Mr. Jamil volunteered his views relevant to breach of duty. Surprisingly, he did not defer on that issue to the experts instructed to consider breach of duty."
Yes, and I think that's a classic example of the problem that I've been talking about. I think the rule really ought to be, if your causation expert puts breach of duty evidence in their report, take it out. But if, on very careful reflection, you consider it would be tactically sensible to keep it in, then I think, as a minimum precaution, make sure that it is qualified by a suitable statement to the effect that the expert is aware that in offering that opinion, he or she is commenting on the standards to be met in a different specialism and would ultimately defer to the experts from that specialism who are dealing with breach of duty. And of course, if there is some particular reason why the expert considers that they are well placed to express an opinion, I don't know, perhaps they've run training courses for GPs or they helped author the guidelines or something of that sort, then make sure that additional justification is included in the report. Otherwise, I think it's just an open goal at cross-examination time.
So what is your third lesson?
Well, the third lesson, I think, can be summed up by the instruction to an expert not to argue the case. I think that the qualities that judges value above all in expert witnesses are care and balance, and one gets a sense sometimes that the expert may think that what will most impress his instructing lawyers, and perhaps in due course the court, is forceful and unequivocal opinion. But in the latter respect at least, I'm confident that he will be wrong about that. By the time a clinical negligence case gets to trial, it ought to be clear that there are two tenable positions on the critical issues of expert evidence. Even if the opposing position is, in the view of the expert, manifest nonsense, he would, I think, be well advised to keep that opinion to himself in favour of a careful, measured, and analytical explanation of why it's wrong. Appearing to be arrogant or dismissive of another expert opinion inevitably riles the judge and will prompt criticism of the expert.
And we saw this in a recent example in the case of Ruffell and Lovett, where His Honour Judge Ian Hughes QC, an experienced clinical negligence judge, had this to say about the manner in which a pain management expert gave his evidence. "I do not hold against Dr. Jenner the fact that he was uncomfortable in the witness box. Giving evidence in court is stressful, and doing so when one's professional opinion is being challenged is doubly so. Dr. Jenner on several occasions started laughing at propositions put to him by counsel, and he also had a habit of lapsing into lecture mode. In his reports, Dr. Jenner was dismissive of the views of other, equally well-qualified doctors, and moreover, in terms that were at best offhand, at worst rude. I set out examples from Dr. Jenner's reports below. For example, with regards to the medical reports of Dr. Christopher Bass, I entirely disagree with the following. This is entirely incorrect. Dr. Bass does not appear to be aware of any of these basic facts. Dr. Bass has not fully taken into account. When he gave evidence, Dr. Jenner was dismissive of those who did not agree with his rigidly held opinions. When Mr. Ferris put the following proposition to Dr. Jenner, there is no generally accepted or understood pathology or physical explanation for CRPS, Dr. Jenner replied, absolute rubbish and nonsense. This dogmatic approach is inconsistent with the obligation on an expert witness to consider and acknowledge where there is a range of opinions, even if the expert, for his own reasons, rejects them. The content of Mr. Jenner's evidence was combative, and he repeatedly acted as an advocate for the claimant. There was a lack of balance and much argument in his evidence. Rather than answer a question directly, Dr. Jenner would often sidestep and respond with an argument to support the claimant's position. For example, when asked whether low back pain was common in the general population, Dr. Jenner answered that it was common in people with CRPS. Only when an answer was insisted upon did he acknowledge that low back pain was indeed commonplace in the general population.
Pretty painful stuff, but it's worth, I think, quoting at some length from that judgment, because the unfortunate expert in question made just about every single one of the worst mistakes you can make as an expert in terms of the manner in which you present your evidence. And much the same effect, I think, is conveyed in a single paragraph from the judgment in ARCSI and Cambridge University Hospitals NHS Foundation Trust, a judgment of Mr. Justice Spencer of earlier this year, where the expert seems to have come in for fairly similar criticism. Whilst I'm considering Mr. Sanderman's evidence, I can also indicate that his oral evidence was unimpressive. It was intemperate. At one stage, he even used an expletive. I pause to say that I'm afraid it's not possible to tell from the transcript what that was. And there was a failure on his part to address the questions that he was being asked. Recognising the difficulties of some of the questions, not just from counsel but also from the bench, he would stray into other areas and different areas to avoid answering questions. I had no doubt, listening to Mr. Sanderman's evidence, that this was a deliberate ploy on his part to avoid answering the questions. So I think that the lessons from these cases and the advice to give to experts as far as the presentation of their evidence is concerned are straightforward and can probably be summarised like this. First, don't be arrogant. Acknowledge that there are other opinions and that it is your job to explain carefully and analytically why they are wrong. Second, don't be dismissive of other opinions or other experts. Use balanced language in the report and in your oral evidence. It's unlikely that the other expert is incompetent, and even if he is, it does no good for you to say so. Third, don't lecture. You're there to answer questions. Some of the answers may need to be fairly long, but they should always be framed as direct answers to questions. Fourth, Don't laugh at what you consider to be stupid propositions or questions, or otherwise show your contempt for what you may consider to be the deficiencies of the other side's case or its presentation. And fifth, never allow yourself to give the impression that you are arguing the case. It's your job to give clear and accurate answers to questions, not to outsmart the other side's counsel with clever answers that you might think will help win the case.
The difficulty sometimes is that as a barrister, you may feel reticent about giving straightforward advice of this nature to experts, particularly those senior, whether in experience or age. But it is advice that they will almost certainly benefit from.
Yes, and I think they need to get it. Heavy, long-term involvement in expert witness work does not necessarily correlate with experience of giving oral evidence. And even for those experts who have given oral evidence before, and many haven't done so, there will often be gaps of years between their previous appearances. Moreover, I think, the more experienced an expert is, and the more comfortable he's become with the process, then the more liable, perhaps, he is to lapse into the kind of errors illustrated in the cases we've been discussing. So give it tactfully, but give it would be my advice. And I would hope and expect that any sensible expert who is facing giving evidence at a trial would be grateful for the guidance.
And finally, Neil, your last lesson.
Yes, well, the last lesson is perhaps the most straightforward, but also perhaps the most important. And it is simply this: read the papers. There are a number of aspects to this straightforward piece of advice, and we've seen each one of them, I think, conveniently illustrated by the cases to which we've already referred.
So the first is make sure you have seen all the relevant notes, and if not, make clear that your report is provisional upon seeing the rest.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's not unusual in a clinical negligence case, particularly one involving a claimant with a long and complex past medical history, for the medical records to be disclosed piecemeal, a bit at a time. This can create a challenge for experts who are often asked to provide an opinion based on the material they have before them at the time of their instruction. But it can also create a significant cross-examination risk if the expert hasn't made clear in his or her report that the information before them was incomplete.
And this was demonstrated in Ruffle, where the judge in that case made the following criticism of the claimant's pain management expert. When he prepared this first report, the claimant's medical records before him ended on the 23rd of July 2009. More than 4 years of records were missing and important events occurred during that period. Dr. Jenner did not ask for the missing records or qualify his conclusion or express a tentative conclusion. There is no evidence that Dr. Jenner even noticed that years of relevant medical records were missing.
Yes, and you might get away with this in some cases, but there will be some in which you won't. And in Ruffle, the problem was particularly acute because the records that were ignored by the expert contained reference to no fewer than 15 different medical conditions. All of this went some considerable way to undermining the expert's assertion in the joint statement that the claimant was, quotes, fit and well before the index accident.
And next, make sure you have read the witness statements.
Yes, it's a related point, but it's particularly important, of course, when the statements are likely to contain evidence which bears directly on the opinion that you've been asked to express. Now, it may be, on consideration of the evidence, that the expert doesn't think that it materially affects the opinion he expressed at the outset, but it's still important to show that it's been taken into account. The trap is a relatively easy one to fall into because, axiomatically, the initial opinion of the expert will have been produced before the exchange of pleadings and service of witness statements. But that means that care will have to be taken to ensure that the disclosed report contains appropriate reference to the material that has been produced thereafter.
And again, we have the example of ARCSI in which the judge said, "It has to be said that it is surprising to find disclosed as part of the liability evidence a report on liability from an expert which predates the exchange of pleadings. I say that because, in general, an expert would not submit a final report until certain procedures have been followed through, including, not least, exchange of witness statements, and no reasonable expert reporting for a claimant would want to finalise his report until he had had an opportunity to see any witness statements submitted on behalf of the defendant. The importance of that in this case is obvious. Significant and highly material information was contained in the statements, which would have informed Mr. Sandeman's report on causation and the consequence of Mr. Sandeman's report not being revised and being served in its original form is that those statements were not referred to at all and the contents of them were not taken into account. Moving on then to literature and the extent to which experts ought to be familiar with literature on which they rely.
Yes, you have to make sure that you master the literature that you cite in support of your opinion. It's almost always an advantage to be able to back up your opinion with relevant literature, textbooks, articles, papers. But if you cite them, you produce them, you have to be on top of the content. The other side will have read the papers in detail by the time the case reaches trial and will have been assisted by their experts as to potential deficiencies in the literature. Make sure you are on top of the detail and aware of the limitations of any of the research that you've cited.
And again, we have reference in the case of Ruffle to the unfortunate Dr. Jenner. Dr. Jenner relied on several research papers to try and justify his opinion, and he referred to these in his report dated the 9th of April 2016. Dr. Jenner did not add that these papers were the results of studies with animals, not humans. When it was put to him that the studies did not include inflicting pain on the animals, Dr. Jenner said he could not remember what the stimulus was in the studies. And then, make sure you have carefully read your own report before going into the witness box, and if you spot any errors, correct them at the outset.
Yes, you will always be given an opportunity as an expert at the beginning of your evidence by your own counsel to correct any errors or omissions that you may have spotted in your report. And there is no shame in an expert modifying or developing his opinion in light of the expert evidence that has been served by the other side. I mean, on the contrary, it's often the hallmark of a careful and balanced expert. At the start of each expert's occupancy of the witness box, he will be asked whether there are any amendments he would wish to make. And if there are, then the opportunity should be taken to make them and explain briefly why they need to be made. Otherwise, the expert runs the risk of criticism meted out to the very experienced and highly regarded neuroradiology expert in ZZZ, in which the judge said this. Dr. Studley agreed that he had missed two other fractures. They were demonstrated by yellow arrows in the scans exhibited to Dr. Good's report. He pointed out that he wasn't asked to comment on the significance of any other fractures. I observe in passing that Dr. Studley did not correct these errors when asked by the claimant's counsel whether he had any corrections to make, despite the fact that they were evident from Dr. Good's report. Whilst I'm sure that for the most part Dr. Studley was attempting to assist me, I confess his analysis was unconvincing. It was regrettable he should have made the errors noted above, and more concerning still that he had not volunteered corrections to them. Now, I think it's apparent from an analysis of the ZZZ judgment as a whole that those errors to which the judge was referring in this passage didn't go to the heart of the issues in the case, and the expert may well have thought that they weren't worth mentioning. But it's instructive to note the proximity between the judge's observation that he made errors that he did not correct and the overall conclusion that his evidence was unconvincing. An expert may not think that some error or omission in their report is centrally or particularly relevant, but that doesn't stop it being used to undermine their credibility as a whole.
And the case of Harris provides an even starker example. In that case, the claimant's expert would have known, had he considered the defendant expert's report, that he was labouring under a misapprehension as to the type of instrument used in the course of the index surgery. When he gave his evidence, he attempted to persuade the judge that it did not matter, as the nature of the instrument was immaterial to his analysis. And as listeners will see, to put it mildly, the judge disagreed. What is all the more surprising about Mr. Kirkpatrick's failure to carry out even the most basic of checks in the face of the defence expert pointing out to him that he could be labouring under serious misapprehension is that he had recently been criticised by His Honour Judge Clark for making factual assumptions about key matters in the case without taking any steps to check that his assumptions were correct. So, Neil, to sum up for us.
Yes, well, I think the four recent cases we've been discussing demonstrate clearly the importance of ensuring that even the most experienced of experts has a clear understanding of the nature and extent of their role and their obligations. They strongly suggest, I think, that the imparting of some frank, perhaps tactful, but straightforward advice during the course of the case preparation will avoid the pitfalls that they illustrate, all of which, I think, ought to be obvious. If that's done, and to end perhaps on a happier note, I think the chances of receiving judicial endorsements of a kind that also appear in some of the cases we've been discussing will increase significantly. And I think that the flip side of criticism of expert witnesses in judgments is usually that the same judgment will also contain some corresponding praise of the other side's expert, who looks even better by way of comparison. And so the cases that we've been discussing can, I think, both illustrate what not to do and also how to do it.
For those who would like to know more on this topic, Gideon Barth, also of One Crown Office Row, has written an article in the most recent One Core Quarterly Medical Law Review. This will be linked in the blog post accompanying this podcast, as will all the cases we have mentioned in today's episode. Neil, many thanks again for coming along and sharing your experience with us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
And on behalf of Rosalind English and myself, I'd like to wish all our listeners happy holidays, and we hope you'll keep listening in the new year.
LawPod UK was presented by Emma Louise Fenelon and is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast and recommend us to a friend.